Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Dean Newark with co-counsel Josh Johnson. We are ADC appointed for Parrish Carter. I'd like to start with the Miranda issue. As most pertinent here, Miranda holds, quote, an absolute prerequisite to interrogation, close quote, is that a suspect held for questioning, quote, must be clearly informed that he has the right to consult with a lawyer and to have the lawyer with him during interrogation, close quote. Now, for many years, the Aurora Police Department has had a Miranda advisement form that it has used when the police interview suspects. That is Exhibit U, pretrial Exhibit U in the record. And as relevant here, that document states, quote, you have the right to talk to a lawyer and have him present with you while you are being questioned, close quote. The detective, Fern Apfel, who interviewed Mr. Carter in this case, used to use that form. In December 2004, she attended a seminar, interrogation seminar, where she was taught that it was okay to minimize the Miranda advisement. After she attended that seminar, she stopped using the form. So when she interrogated Mr. Carter in September 2005, she only gave him an oral advisement. And instead of telling him that he had a right to talk to a lawyer and to have that lawyer present with him during the questioning, she merely said to him, quote, you have the right to have a lawyer, close quote. Our position is that as a matter of law, that advisement is inadequate and violates Miranda. And cases since Miranda which have addressed this same precise type of advisement that the detective gave here have held that merely telling a suspect you have the right to an attorney does not clearly inform the suspect that that right includes the right to talk to the lawyer before being questioned by the police and the right to have the lawyer present during questioning by the police.
Counsel, so what would a Miranda compliant advisement look like as to that particular right? What would a police officer have to tell the person that's being held?
One of the cases we've cited, and under Exhibit U, what the suspect needs to be told is you have the right to talk to a lawyer before we question you and to have that lawyer with you while you're being questioned, rather than merely saying you have the right to a lawyer, which has no temporal element to it and does not inform the suspect that the right to the lawyer attaches right then and there before the police proceed with the questioning, so that the suspect can make an informed decision whether to invoke his or her privilege against self-incrimination.
Counsel, it seems to me that what you're asking this court to conclude is that an advisement like the FBI advisement that the Supreme Court in Powell said was not required, that's what you're asking us to effectively adopt.
Well, in Powell, Justice Ginsburg wrote that the FBI advisement was exemplary or some similar high standard of praise. And while she didn't say that it needs to be adopted word for word, what she did hold and what the U.S. Supreme Court has consistently held in its cases since Miranda is that the suspect does need to be told in some fashion through some combination of words that he or she has a right to a lawyer then and there at the time of the interrogation. That element cannot be wholly admitted. If you look at the advisement as a whole and there's an indication that the suspect was told of the right before or during, that's enough under Supreme Court jurisprudence. But if that element is wholly missing as it was here, then that is not enough. And the Supreme Court has not addressed that specific issue, which is why there's this split in various cases around the country.
Now, can something else substitute for that? For example, the fact that apparently this defendant, this was not the first time he had encounters with police. Can that help supplement the Miranda advisement?
It does not, Your Honor, because if you read Miranda, it sets forth a blanket rule and it says the suspect must be told these rights every time he or she is in custodial interrogation. It doesn't matter how smart the person is, whether they know the rights, whether they have been Mirandized before, They have to be told because it's the only way that we on the Supreme Court can be sure that in the pressures of that particular situation, in a custodial interrogation where the right to self-incrimination is subject to the inherent pressures of custodial interrogation, it's the only way to know for sure that that suspect is aware of his or her rights and can meaningfully decide whether to exercise them or waive them. And in this instance, although Mr. Carter did have prior experience with the criminal justice system, there's nothing in the record to indicate that he'd ever been placed in custodial interrogation in a room like he was here. His prior experiences in the record were in a courtroom with a lawyer, where he was entering into plea bargains and was waiving rights with the advice and assistance of a lawyer, and he did not have that here. So even if it were relevant, it wouldn't be a factor applicable in this situation.
Thank you.
So for these reasons, and I would point the court, among the cases we've cited, the cases that have really almost a verbatim recitation of warning that we have here, which deal with the express issue that I've just described and which reach the result that we're advocating. The Harris case out of Louisiana, 2012, the Williams case out of Louisiana, 2014, the Coffey case out of Texas, 2014, which we provided to the court last week. These are all recent cases which have the benefit of the ability to go back and review all the past case law on this specific issue. They say it's not enough to tell the suspect you have the right to a lawyer. You have to, in some fashion, convey the right attaches now, and it's during, right to consult now, and have the lawyer present during the questioning. Now, Miranda also holds that unless these proper warnings are given, there's a per se bar to the admissibility of any statements that follow, because that's the situation here. We would ask that this court find that the trial court erroneously denied the motion to suppress and therefore reverse on that basis. Finally, turn to the Jingles issue. I call it the Jingles issue because it's really the Frasco de Bella issue that we briefed. At the time that we did our briefing, the applicability of Frasco and de Bella to a defendant's testimonial exhibit was an issue of first impression in Colorado. Since then, a panel of this court has issued the Jingles decision. Jingles held that Frasco and de Bella do not apply to a defendant's confession, in other words, where the testimonial exhibit is a defendant's confession. And the reasoning for that ruling was that there was a historic recognition that a confession is uniquely powerful evidence. The problem with applying Jingles in this case is that there is no confession here. In fact, during the opposition to the motion to suppress in the trial court, the district attorney made the following statement to the court. Quote, there was no confession here. From the beginning to the end, Mr. Carter fought them every step of the way. Close quote. That's on page 6942 of the CD containing the trial transcripts, lines 22 to 23. That's from the September 13th, 2007 oral argument on the motion to suppress. So since the prosecution itself argued below to the court that there was no confession, our position is that the prosecution in this court would be judicially stopped from asserting that there was.
Okay, let me tie that point, the lack of a confession, back to the first issue. So he didn't incriminate himself. He didn't admit to committing any of the crimes. So why isn't the admission of the videotaped interrogation harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
So there's another part, to answer your question, Judge Fox, there's another part of Miranda which talks about how the statements are characterized, and it says, I'm going to point it out to you, it's 384 United States Reporter at page 477. It's the bottom of page 476 carrying over the top of page 477, and it says, it doesn't matter whether the statements made after an inadequate Miranda advisement are characterized as being inculpatory or exculpatory. And it says, number one, if the prosecution wants to use it at all, it means it has some inculpatory value. Number two, it doesn't matter because we on the Supreme Court through Miranda are setting forth a blanket rule that needs to be followed regardless. And it doesn't matter what the defendant says. The defendant's statements following inadequate Miranda advisement are per se inadmissible.
Let me ask you, the psychiatrist's report or testimony referred to that, those statements. And that's the psychologist or psychiatrist that was introduced by the defense. So didn't the defense introduce the issue of the statement of the interrogation by way of their testimony?
Are you talking about at the trial, Your Honor, or at the suppression hearing?
At the suppression hearing.
So at the suppression hearing, there was another issue being decided, which was the validity of Mr. Carter's waiver, if there had been an adequate Miranda advisement. So first, the trial judge, when he ruled, decided there was an adequate Miranda advisement. He said that the advisement was perfunctory, but it still complied with Miranda. We disagree with that. Having passed that hurdle, he then had to address whether Mr. Carter knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived his rights, for which Mr. Carter's subjective understanding became at issue, and that was what Dr. Pendleton's testimony related to. If I could turn very quickly also on the Jingles issue, Jingles has an analytical flaw in that it overlooks the fact that a deliberating jury's access to a confession is limited by the same concept of unfair prejudice that underlies Fraskill and Davila. Fraskill and Davila hold that a trial court must exercise its discretion to prevent an exhibit from being used in a manner unfairly prejudicial to a party. Jingles relies heavily on Miller, which is a 1991 case from this court, which quotes an Illinois Supreme Court case. And if you look below the part of that Illinois Supreme Court case quoted in Miller, you see additional language which acknowledges the possibility of, quote, an abuse of discretion to the prejudice of the defendant, close quote. That's 236 Northeast 2nd at 714. And similarly, Jingles quotes a case, Flannery v. Delaware, but ignores language which appears below the language cited in Flannery, which says that a defendant can use a 403 analysis to move to exclude a confession from going back to the jury room for deliberations. That's page 893, A2nd at 529. So the sources on which the Jingles case itself is based acknowledge that giving a deliberating jury access to a confession, so assuming we have a confession, could unfairly prejudice a defendant in some circumstances. That's the same concept of unfair prejudice at work in Frasco and Davila, and therefore Frasco and Davila's rule should apply to testimonial exhibits of defendant statements. Unless the court has any other questions, I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, May.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Lorblois, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. Looking first to the Miranda advisement issue, I too want to turn to the Miranda decision, specifically the holding on page 479 of that decision. What the court held is a defendant must be warned prior to any questioning that he has the right to remain silent, that anything he says can be used against him in a court of law, that he has the right to a presence of an attorney, and if he cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed for him prior to any questioning if he so desires.
But isn't the presence of an attorney in the area that you just read, isn't that what's missing here? The presence of an attorney.
Your Honor, my position would be that telling a defendant immediately before custodial interrogation that he has a right to an attorney, it's understandable that that means the attorney's presence. And the defense argument has been with the temporal aspect of this, whether he has the right to the attorney's presence before and during the interrogation. Now, I think it's very important that Miranda specifically said that no particular words are necessary as long as these four bites are adequately conveyed. And the court has repeatedly said in decisions since Miranda that no talismanic incantation is required to satisfy Miranda. Now, if we look at what the Colorado Supreme Court has said with regard to Miranda, in Hopkins, the Colorado Supreme Court has said, what is required is that the suspect be adequately informed. He has a right not to say anything, that what he says can be used against him in court, that he has the right to the presence of an attorney, and that if he cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed for him prior to questioning if he so desires.
The presence of an attorney, which is one of the arguments that's missing in the advisement of the defendant here.
Your Honor?
I mean, I agree that the argument goes further, that the defendant argues that it should have added, you have a right to an attorney and the presence of an attorney during interrogation.
Your Honor, my position is, as I said, that the right to an attorney obviously means, when said immediately prior to custodial interrogation, that you have the right to have an attorney here now. So that's my position with regard to the fact that the actual words presence weren't used. I'm trying to set this up with what the Colorado Supreme Court has said, and then I want to talk specifically about the advisement here. So in the Jordan case, what the court said was, under Miranda, before a person can be subjected to custodial interrogation by the police, he must be advised of the following rights: that he has the right to remain silent, that any statement he makes can be used as evidence against him, he has the right to the presence of an attorney, either retained or appointed. So that mentions nothing about timing. Now, if we look at the advisement here, what we have the detective saying is, since you're in custody, before I can even talk to you, I do the formal little rights thing, okay? So you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to have an attorney. If you cannot afford to hire an attorney, one will be appointed to you without cost. Do you understand these? Now, in deciding that this advisement was minimally adequate, the court specifically noted the officer's use of the word before immediately preceding these words. What the court said is, she did say to him, indicating she could not talk to him unless she gave him these Miranda rights, and she said, before I can talk to you, and then gave him the four rights. So if we look at this in context, the idea of the lawyer's presence before the defendant speaks to the officer is within this particular advisement given by the detective. Now, it's true that we don't have this language that it continues during the defendant's interview, but I think that can be inferred from the circumstances, and that was, in fact, the issue in the Powell case. In the Powell case, the defendant was warned that he, in fact, had the right to an attorney before questioning, and the defense argument in the Powell case was he wasn't told that this would be continuing through his interrogation.
Ms. Warbaugh, Powell also said that the warnings must reasonably convey to a suspect his rights as required by Miranda. I mean, we'll argue about what exactly this advisement meant, and, you know, presumably we're people that could reasonably, you know, attribute some meaning to that. But here we have a defendant who had some mental challenges. Wouldn't that in turn militate for even more detailed and even additional warning so that, you know, the officer made sure that he understood exactly what he was waiving? Why not perform that, I guess, Aurora PD used to give to everybody, or some of the other officers use, where he had to initial line by line each of the rights he was waiving? I mean, why not that, especially given the limitations of this defendant?
Well, Your Honor, that goes to the question of the validity of the waiver, which I agree with the defense that the defendant's mental challenges go to the question of the validity of the waiver. The defense has specifically said it is not challenging the waiver on appeal. So, I mean, clearly it was an argument in the trial court, and what the defense argued was the defendant would have had a more complete understanding of his rights if, in fact, the officer had used the form. So, clearly that was an issue below. Clearly, as I said, it's relevant to the defendant's knowing an intelligent waiver of his rights. That's not the issue the defense is apparently raising on appeal. The words used by the Supreme Court in Powell were admirably informative. And the trial court here, in denying the motion to suppress, similarly said that, yeah, it might have been a good thing had the officer given the written advisement form. But an officer is not required to make an explanation that complete under Miranda. Miranda involves a short advisement, and the defendant is asked whether he, in fact, understands those rights. That's then an opportunity for a defendant who does not understand the temporal aspect or the payment aspect of having an attorney appointed. That's his chance to ask questions, is when the officer says, do you understand these rights?
But do you think there's any relevance here that the officer intentionally deviated from the written advisement after the officer attended this seminar, where the whole purpose of the seminar was to minimize the effect of Miranda?
Your Honor,
do you think there's any significance to that?
Your Honor, I don't think there's any significance to that, because that goes to the officer's subjective motivation. And I don't think we care about the officer's subjective motivation, either for the question of whether the Miranda advisement is adequate, because it either is or it isn't, no matter what the officer's motivation is, nor do we care about it with regard to the validity of the defendant's knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver. Because I don't think the officer's motivation, her subjective motivation, is in fact relevant to the defendant's validity of his waiver. In looking at the admission of the defendant's statements, I'd like to turn now to the question of whether they could be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Because in terms of inculpatory and exculpatory statements made by the defendant admitted that he was in the bar and that he had spoken to the victim, although he denied it threatening the victim. And there's really overwhelming evidence the defendant was in the bar. I mean, there's the surveillance tape, there's the testimony of his friends and co-defendants and colleagues who were waiting for him in the parking lot, who sent him in and then took him away. There's also the testimony of the victim's friends. So clearly, the fact that the defendant admitted that he was in the bar and during the course of the custodial interrogation is not prejudicial under the circumstances because of the overwhelming evidence that he was, in fact, in the bar. With regard to the defendant's being able to form the necessary culpable mental states for the crime, the prosecution presented a lot of testimony from lay witnesses regarding their perceptions of the defendant's capabilities. So we have, in particular, testimony from Robert Ray's wife and from the defendant's ex-girlfriend about the fact that although the defendant was slow, that he could put plans into action. It's also very important that in closing argument, the defense counsel told the jury that, in fact, the defendant's videotaped statements supported the defense case. And I'll read that. It's from the CD page 10-9-35, but I'll read that briefly to you. He said, LaToya described him as mind sideways, mind somewhere else, looked off into space, acted like a child. Other witnesses described him as a pawn, a pigeon, a gopher. What does that mean? He didn't form the mental state of intentionally in Gibbies. The other people's view of him, Mr. Owens and Mr. Ray, was absolutely right, and they wouldn't have entrusted him. And you had the chance to see him when you talked to Detective Frontacrawl as well. And I suggest the video corroborates all that as well. So we actually have the defense urging the jury that the defendant's videotaped statements support the defense case. So for that reason, it's harmless beyond reasonable doubt.
But we also have the district attorney referring repeatedly to the tape to indicate the opposite.
Yes, Your Honor, it's open to both interpretations, but I'm saying in terms of prejudice to the defense itself urged that it corroborated the defense position. Finally, in evaluating the harmlessness, it's important to note that the jury returned the victim's verdicts acquitting the defendant on the most serious charge against him, that of first-degree murder after deliberation. The jury also acquitted on bribing a witness. So it shows that this was not so prejudicial that the jury found it necessary to convict the defendant on all these charges. The jury obviously was able to put the statements in perspective and to acquit on those things that they felt the prosecution, to acquit on those things they felt the prosecution had not proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and to convict on those charges the prosecution had proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Turning now to what I will also call the Jingles issue, I would certainly commend this court's attention to the analysis in the Jingles case, which clearly supports my position that there are different lines of reasoning between what is a witness statement, which is what Frasco and DiBella were concerned with, and a defendant's own statements. And that's in large part because the concern about the witness statements is that they constitute testimonial hearsay. And we simply don't have that with the defendant's own statements. They are his voluntary statements and have a crucial importance to the case in that way. I would like to say that I think it's artificial to say that the word confession means that there have to be actually inculpatory statements, because I think any defendant's statements, we also call them admissions, by the way, and an admission or a confession would be synonyms, and this is in fact an admission of a party.
The Supreme Court statement in Miranda that the statement, if it's improper collection of the statement, it should not be introduced by the prosecution, whether or not it's inculpatory or exculpatory.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. But my point is with regard to the Jingles case that I think the defense saying this isn't a confession is not something we look at. It's in fact the defendant's own statements, and I think any defendant's statements run the spectrum between inculpatory and exculpatory, and I would agree with what you've said, Judge May, that under Miranda, neither is admissible if there hasn't been a proper advisement and waiver.
Right. Okay.
What I'm saying is that I don't think that it makes a difference that the defendant's statements were largely not inculpatory. I mean, he didn't inculpate himself in being in the bar. So we have that much of a confession, if you will. But I think any statement is going to be a mix of inculpatory and exculpatory statements. And it's not only an inculpatory statement which falls under this analysis that Judge Daly offered in Jingles about why we think a defendant's statements may be used by a jury without reservation, unlike a witness's statement.
Thank you. I see your time is up.
It is. I ask you to affirm the defense conviction.
We have a short rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. On Miranda, the part on page 479 that Ms. Robar read to you is not a holding. That's a summary at the end of the opinion. The holding is relevant to the argument we're raising is on pages 471 and 472. Quote, we hold that an individual held for interrogation must be clearly informed that he has the right to consult with a lawyer and to have the lawyer with him during interrogation, close quote. What happens in Miranda is that at the beginning of the opinion on page 444, there's a summary. That's where they use the word presence. In that summary, the court wrote, our holding will be spelled out with some specificity in the pages which follow. Part that I read to you from 471 to 72 is the holding, and then again on page 479, they recap presence. The actual holding says you got to tell them in some fashion you have a right to a lawyer during. That's what every U.S. Supreme Court case since then has indicated must be conveyed. So is the Colorado Supreme Court. In our reply brief, we cite the very recent Colorado Supreme Court of Sanchez, which characterizes this right, the right that's been summarized as the right to the presence of a lawyer, to the right to have a lawyer, right to a lawyer before and during interrogation. And then last on this point on harmlessness, the fact that trial counsel tried to make lemons into lemonade is in closing argument is something that lawyers, defense lawyers, are expected to do. In fact, in the DeBell case, the Supreme Court said that we are not going to hold it against defense counsel that once this statement was admitted, defense counsel tried to put the best spin on it in closing argument that he possibly could. Therefore, the fact that defense counsel here did the same thing has no impact for harmlessness purposes. Unless the court has any other questions, I'd ask the court to reverse and send this case back for a new trial.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your fine arguments. They will be very helpful to the court as we deliberate. And the case is now being submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. And thank you both, and travel home safely.
Thank you.